So, in just 3 years, generative AI completely wiped out 20% of entry-level software coding jobs globally.
Yeah, 20% just gone.
Right. And it hit a 53% global adoption rate, which is, faster than the personal computer, faster than the internet
It's
itself.
an unprecedented velocity, honestly.
Exactly. And the narrative we're used to is that the global north is building these algorithms for the 21st century, but they're increasingly powering them with the data, the behavior, and basically the digital labor of the global south.
Which is the core tension we're looking at today.
Yeah. But today we are looking at a really groundbreaking document out of South Africa that basically says, the digital colonization stops here. So welcome to the deep dive.
Thanks. Yeah, it's a profound pivot point we're examining today. Because when you look at the sheer speed of this technology, the stakes are, well, they're basically existential.
Definitely. And we're specifically diving into the brand new South African draft National Artificial Intelligence Policy, which was just published on April 10th, 2026.
Right. And to really understand why this specific document is just sending shockwaves through the tech community, we kind of have to unpack the global pressure cooker it was forged in, you know?
So let's set that global context for everyone, because for the last 5 years, the story we've been fed is that Silicon Valley just has this like insurmountable monopoly on
Oh,
AI.
absolutely. That was the prevailing wisdom.
But I'm looking at the data from the newly released Stanford AI Index 2026 report, and that whole narrative is just crumbling.
It's completely fragmenting. I mean, what's really fascinating here is the shifting geopolitical balance that's hidden inside that rapid adoption curve.
Right.
Like, if you look at the Stanford report, the capability gap between the United States and China,
It's practically evaporated.
Wait, really? It's
pretty
gone.
much. The U.S. currently leads China's best AI model by this microscopic margin. It's a mere 2.7%.
Wow, so they are virtually neck and neck at this point.
Exactly.
So, for you listening, what does that 2.7% margin actually mean for the rest of the world?
Well, practically, it means the era of the unilateral AI superpower is just over. Because those top-tier models are so fiercely competitive now, we're seeing this massive spillover effect.
Spillover in what way? Like open source?
Yeah, exactly. Highly capable open-source models are just being released into the wild at an unprecedented rate, mostly because these tech giants are desperately trying to undercut each other.
Ah, I see. So it creates this super volatile but also highly opportunistic environment for everyone else.
Precisely. Which brings us to the ground-level economic reality.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't just a theoretical chess match between Washington and Beijing anymore.
Right. It's not just academics arguing. We are seeing immediate, pretty violent shocks to the labor market.
Very violent.
Like the Stanford report noted that 20% drop in entry-level developer jobs in a single year. And it specifically hit recent grads, right? Like 22 to 25-year-olds.
Yeah, the new workforce is taking the brunt of it.
Yeah.
Because the AI is no longer just, writing polite emails or summarizing meetings.
It's doing the actual heavy lifting.
Exactly. It's doing the fundamental architectural work of the digital economy. It's writing boilerplate code, it's executing quality assurance tests.
And building the infrastructure, which really leaves a developing nation with a terrifying choice.
It really does. You basically have two options. You either figure out how to harness this tech to build your own infrastructure,
Or
or
you just become completely reliant on foreign algorithms that automate your local workforce out of existence.
right, you become a digital dependency.
So let's kind of unpack this, because with this hyper-accelerated global backdrop, our mission for this deep dive is to figure out exactly how the African continent, and specifically South Africa, is fighting back.
And it is a massive fight.
It is. We're going to analyze the architecture of this 2026 draft AI policy. We're going to explore this really profound concept of algorithmic sovereignty.
Which is such a crucial term right now.
Right. And we'll look at the vital work and some of the critiques coming from organizations like the African Institute for Data Science and AI. That's AFRID SAII.
Yeah, their fellows have been super vocal about this.
Exactly. Scholars warning about the risks of a new, like, digital imperialism. And finally, we want to discover how local grassroots academic networks are quietly building the physical engine for an independent tech future.
It's a huge undertaking. Because when you read through the source material, you realize pretty quickly this isn't just about regulating software.
No, not all.
It's basically a blueprint for national survival. It's about epistemic independence.
I know that when you hear a phrase like national policy framework, it sounds like the driest, most bureaucratic thing imaginable.
Oh, absolutely. It puts people right to sleep.
But I promise you, this is actually a story about power. It's about resistance and who gets to define human knowledge and ultimately who gets to profit from it.
So let's look at the blueprint itself, right? The core vision of the 2026 South African draft AI policy is stated pretty explicitly.
Yeah, it says AI for inclusive economic growth, job creation, cost reduction, and a developing Africa.
Right, which on its face is a very standard, noble political objective. You see that in a lot of documents.
Sure, it sounds great.
But the mechanics of how they actually intend to achieve that, that's where it gets really complex.
Mm-hmm.
The drafters have proposed this very deliberate 3-year staged implementation approach.
Okay, a 3-year plan. How is that broken down?
Well, year one is entirely dedicated to finalization. So setting up the policy framework, locking down the foundational legal definitions.
Mm-hmm.
Then year two focuses on creating specific regulatory guidelines and, crucially, identifying high-risk use cases.
Wait, hold on a second. A 3-year rollout?
Yeah, 3 years.
I mean, generative AI completely reshaped the internet in, like, 3 months. By the time this policy hits year three, which is supposed to be full cross-sector implementation, we could have quantum computing integrating with commercial AI.
It's very possible.
The whole underlying architecture of neural networks could be different. So how does a developing nation draft a 3-year blueprint for a house when, you know, the fundamental laws of physics are changing every 3 weeks?
Right.
This policy is going to be a fossil before the ink even dries, isn't it?
Well, this raises a really important question, and it's honestly the central dilemma of tech regulation globally right now.
How so?
The South African government is basically trying to walk a nearly impossible tightrope here. Because if they overregulate with very rigid, code-specific laws,
they crush their own startups.
Exactly. They instantly crush the local startups they desperately need to stimulate the economy. But if they underregulate,
then they expose their citizens to, like, catastrophic algorithmic harm.
Precisely. So the mechanism they're using to survive this crazy rapid evolution is a concept called technology neutrality.
Okay, technology neutrality. Meaning what, exactly, under the hood?
It means they do not regulate the software code itself.
Yeah.
The law doesn't actually care if a system uses a large language model or a generative adversarial network or some crazy future quantum hybrid thing that hasn't even been invented yet.
Oh, interesting. So what do they regulate?
They regulate the outcome, the application. So if an algorithm makes a decision about your credit score, the law regulates the fairness of that specific credit decision, completely regardless of the math that was used to reach it.
Ah, that makes a lot of sense. You regulate the impact, not the mechanics.
Exactly.
And speaking of impact, the governance structures they're setting up in year one are pretty heavy. I mean, we're looking at an AI ethics board, a national AI safety institute, and an AI ombudsperson.
Yeah, the ombudsperson is a particularly interesting addition, because it creates a direct, accessible channel for the public to actually file grievances when an automated system harms them.
Right.
Like, imagine an automated human resources screening tool, right? And it systematically filters out resumes from a specific postal code just because the AI determined that area has a lower statistical rate of long-term employment.
Oh, wow. And a postal code in South Africa that, due to the history of the country, is almost certainly delineated by race.
Exactly the issue.
Yeah.
So the ombudsperson provides a legal mechanism for a regular citizen to say, hey, I was harmed by a machine and I demand a human review.
That's powerful.
It is. And furthermore, the entire framework of this policy is strictly bound to the South African Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and POPIA, which is the Protection of Personal Information Act.
Right. And this is where I think we really have to pause and look at the specific historical context of South Africa.
Yeah, it's a crucial.
Because if you read AI policies from, say, Europe or the US, privacy and rights are definitely mentioned. But in this South African draft, these constitutional guardrails are the absolute foundation. Why is that so heavily emphasized?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, you have to remember that South Africa is dealing with deep, entrenched structural inequalities. This is the direct lived legacy of apartheid.
Right.
Which was a system that meticulously used data. I mean, passbooks, racial classifications, demographic tracking. They use data to oppress and exclude the vast majority of population.
So in that context, data isn't just ones and zeros. It actually has a violent history.
Precisely. Technology is never just neutral. It's an amplifier of intent.
Yeah.
If you take a highly efficient, optimizing algorithm and you unleash it into historically unequal society without heavy socioeconomic guardrails.
It's just going to optimize those exact inequalities.
Exactly. It will look at the historical data, see that capital was concentrated in certain demographics, and efficiently decide, oh, those demographics are the safest bet for future capital allocation.
Man, so from the perspective of the policy drafters, AI cannot just be viewed as like a cool tech tool for corporate efficiency.
No, it must be actively designed and legally restrained to act as a socioeconomic leveler.
It's sort of like teaching a child to read using only history books written by oppressors from the 1950s. Like, the child isn't inherently bad at reading, and the neural network isn't inherently malicious.
Right.
But their vocabulary, their worldview, their whole understanding of who deserves what, it's all going to be trapped in a prejudiced past.
That is a perfect analogy for algorithmic bias. The AI is simply finding the most efficient mathematical path through poisoned data.
Wow. Poisoned data.
And that is exactly why the draft policy includes a very strict mandate for explainable AI, specifically for what they define as high-risk systems.
So let's break down what high-risk actually means in this specific context.
Sure. So high-risk use cases are situations where an algorithmic decision fundamentally alters a human life.
Okay, like what?
We're talking about automated criminal justice sentencing recommendations, or algorithmic loan and mortgage approvals, or AI-driven medical diagnostics.
High-stakes stuff.
Very. And in these scenarios, the policy explicitly states the AI cannot be a black box. The decisions it makes must be understandable and explainable by a human being to a human being.
Okay, but mathematically, how do you actually enforce that? Because deep learning models, by their very nature, have billions of parameters.
Billions, yeah.
I mean, even the engineers who build these models in Silicon Valley often admit they don't know exactly why the model chose a specific word or made a connection. So how does the South African government legally mandate explainability on a system that is, like, inherently unexplainable?
Right. That is the major friction point.
Yeah.
And the policy attempts to bridge this gap through mandatory impact assessments.
Okay.
So before a high-risk system can even be deployed, the deploying entity has to conduct deep adversarial testing. And we aren't just talking about technical cybersecurity checks here.
What kind of checks, then?
The law mandates human rights impact assessments, gender impact assessments, even environmental impact assessments.
Right, so you have to essentially red team the AI for human rights violations before you're legally allowed to turn it on.
Yes, exactly. You have to feed the model edge case scenarios from the local context. You aggressively test to see if, say, the medical diagnostic tool misdiagnoses skin conditions on darker skin tones.
Which is a massive documented failure in Western-trained AI models already.
It is. Or you test if the natural language processor flags local African dialects as unprofessional or aggressive in a customer service environment.
Oh, that makes total sense. Because if you don't test for that, the legal nightmare when this technology inevitably goes wrong is just, it's staggering.
Oh, it's a mess.
Let's say a hospital deploys an AI diagnostic tool, right? The AI makes a subtle error and a patient is disastrously misdiagnosed. In a normal legal system, who do you even sue?
Right. Who's at fault?
Do you sue the hospital that bought the software? Do you sue the developer sitting in an office park in California? Do you sue the underpaid data labeler in Kenya who accidentally mislabeled the initial training image 3 years ago?
The chain of causality is completely shattered by the black box.
Mm-hmm.
The liability is incredibly unclear, and traditional tort law is just simply not equipped to handle a diffuse network of algorithms.
So South Africa proposes this incredibly pragmatic bypass to this whole legal nightmare, and it's a mechanism that really caught my eye when I was reading the draft, the AI Insurance Superfund.
Yeah, it's a highly innovative, albeit pretty controversial, approach to algorithmic harm.
It completely sidesteps the blame game.
It does.
The Superfund is basically a pooled financial safety net. It's designed to compensate citizens for damages when AI liability can't be immediately proven or traced back to a single corporation.
Exactly. It basically says to the public, look, we know this technology is going to break things. We know it will make catastrophic errors.
And we won't let everyday citizens foot the bill.
Right. Or spend a decade in court while international corporate lawyers argue over proprietary code.
It's such a necessary safety net for the reality we actually live in. But, you know, if you really analyze the subtext of that Superfund, it highlights a much deeper, more systemic anxiety within the policy itself.
How so?
Well, South Africa's primary interaction with AI is just regulating foreign technology that gets imported into the country. You know, setting up ombudspersons, paying out insurance claims when it breaks. they're always going to be playing defense.
I see what you mean.
They are just constantly reacting to the symptoms of a technology they don't actually control.
Which brings us to the core thesis of this deep dive. It is not enough to just build a regulatory fortress around your country. A shield doesn't win a revolution.
No, it doesn't.
If you want true independence in the 21st century, you have to own the raw materials, the refineries, and the manufacturing process of the digital age.
Yes.
And that introduces this crucial fight for algorithmic sovereignty.
So let's talk about that, because algorithmic sovereignty is perhaps the most vital concept in the entire Global South AI discourse right now.
Without a doubt.
And it's defined as the capacity of a nation or a region to design, develop, deploy, and govern AI systems locally.
Right, local control.
It means building the infrastructure so that the AI serves domestic needs, respects domestic laws, and crucially embodies domestic values.
It's the difference between buying a finished, highly expensive product off a foreign shelf versus owning the factory that actually designs and builds the product tailored to your exact specifications.
Exactly. And the academic critiques coming from African scholars on this front are really piercing. They argue that the current South African draft policy, while well-intentioned, just doesn't go far enough in actively funding this sovereignty.
Yeah, there's a lot of pushback.
In the sources we're looking at, they cite extensive work from researchers like Emma Rutkamp-Bloom and fellows from the African Institute for Data Science and AI AFRID SAI like Okri. And they're issuing severe warnings about a concept called epistemic injustice.
Let's really break that down. Because epistemic injustice sounds like, you know, high-level philosophy.
Yeah, it sounds super academic.
But it has brutal real-world consequences.
Mm.
Epistemology is the study of knowledge, right? How we know what we know and whose knowledge is actually considered valid.
Okay.
So epistemic injustice occurs when a dominant system completely invalidates, ignores, or marginalizes your specific way of understanding the world.
I see.
In the context of global AI, the world is rapidly building a universal AI mind. We're building these massive language models that act as the arbiters of truth, logic, and reasoning.
Right.
But the foundational data, the training, and the reinforcement of that quote-unquote universal mind, it almost entirely excludes African philosophies, languages, and ethical frameworks.
Wow. So, like, if an AI evaluates a community's creditworthiness based entirely on individual hyper-capitalist accumulation, which is basically the Silicon Valley baseline.
Right, individual wealth.
Rather than evaluating communal obligations or shared resources or cooperative trust networks, which are foundational to many African societies, the AI isn't just making a math error.
No, it's committing an epistemic injustice. It's judging an entire culture through an alien, incompatible lens and then actively penalizing them for it.
Man, what's so fascinating here is how clearly this mirrors historical patterns.
Oh, it's basically a repeat.
Scholars linked to AFRID SII and others are pointing to this phenomenon known as the algorithmic colonization of Africa.
Yeah, that term is gaining a lot of traction.
They argue that big tech companies are pouring into the continent under the guise of, like, technological solutionism.
Right, the classic Silicon Valley pitch. You know, we're here to save you. We'll bank the unbanked. We'll cure your diseases with our AI diagnostics. We'll optimize your agriculture from space.
Right. But underneath that shiny philanthropic PR campaign, it is fundamentally a massive, unprecedented data grab.
It is.
And here's where it gets really interesting to me. Think about how the global economy has treated the African continent for centuries.
Extraction.
Exactly. Africa exported raw materials. Gold, cocoa, diamonds, copper, and usually at rock bottom prices. Those raw materials were shipped to the global north, refined, manufactured into luxury jewelry or electronics, and then sold back to African nations at an enormous, crippling premium.
Yeah, the literal infrastructure of extraction.
Now look at the digital economy. Are we just building the exact same extractive railroad but replacing the iron tracks with fiber optic cables?
It certainly looks that way.
I mean, African nations are currently exporting massive amounts of raw behavioral data, which is basically the digital equivalent of unrefined crude oil. That data flows to server farms in California or Washington state. It gets refined by Western engineers, trained on Western values, optimized for Western profit margins, and then packaged into these enterprise algorithm subscriptions that are sold back to African hospitals, banks, and governments.
And to add insult to injury, those expensive imported algorithms often don't even properly understand local dialects or cultural context or hyper-local market dynamics.
Exactly.
This is the precise argument being articulated by African academics. In fact, this was heavily highlighted in recent sideline statements at World Development Consultations, where AFRID SAI helped co-organize.
Right, the participants issued a very strong statement there.
They did. Their point was that if local research and development capabilities aren't prioritized, the Fourth Industrial Revolution will simply recycle and reinforce the unequal exploitative divisions of the first three industrial revolutions.
It's a brand new, highly sophisticated technology, but it's the exact same power dynamic. There's a quote in the source material from civil rights activist Audre Lorde that I think perfectly encapsulates this academic critique. She said, "The master's tools will never dismantle the master's house."
It is a incredibly powerful framework for this dilemma.
Yeah.
The academics argue that adopting global North AI models isn't just technologically insufficient, it's actively harmful because it enforces a foreign extractive worldview.
Right. If you want to build an equitable, developmentally sovereign, Afrocentric future, you simply cannot build it using algorithms that were mathematically optimized for Western hypercapitalism.
You just can't.
You have to build endogenous creation. Yeah. You have to build from within. But how do you actually do that? I mean, practically speaking, how do you embed African political thought into the cold, hard mathematics of an algorithm?
Well, you build algorithmic refineries.
Okay. What does that look like?
You build local academic and research institutions that actually have the capacity to define their own mathematical objective functions. And the exciting part is, we are actually seeing the blueprints for these sovereign engines being built right now.
Oh, really? Where?
Well, our sources point to a massive growth in academic institutes across South Africa. A prime example is the Wits University Machine Intelligence and Neural Discovery Institute, the MIND Institute.
Okay, so they aren't just taking an open source model from an American company and, like, tweaking the edges.
No, not at all. They're focusing on foundational, fundamental AI science. They're building intellectual infrastructure from the ground up.
Wow.
They're researching how neural networks can be inherently designed to process multiple African languages natively, rather than just translating them through an English bottleneck first, which, you know, completely destroys the morphological structure of the language.
Right. And this ties directly into the work of groups like AFRID SAI, right? Yeah. Because they aren't just researching in a vacuum. Like we mentioned, they recently co-organized that massive consultation session for the World Development Report.
Yes. And what is really critical about that consultation is what happened on the sidelines.
The statement they issued.
Exactly. A statement was issued by the African participants that laid out a clear, uncompromising demand for African AI development. It highlighted that isolated pockets of excellence at places like WITS or the University of Johannesburg, I mean, they're fantastic, but they aren't enough to secure actual sovereignty.
Because even a highly developed South African research sector can't achieve true algorithmic sovereignty alone against the, you know, multi-trillion dollar scale of global tech monopolies.
It's impossible.
South Africa's entire GDP is just a fraction of the market capitalization of just one of these tech giants.
Right. So if we connect this to the bigger picture, you need a united front. To truly combat digital colonialism and build sovereign developmental capacity, you have to scale up to the continental level.
Mm-hmm. You need scale.
You do. The algorithms need massive data sets, and they need massive computing power. Which brings us to the Pan-African context and this incredibly dynamic push for what the academic sources refer to as prefigurative politics.
Okay, let's broaden the lens then, because beyond South Africa's draft policy, we have to look at the African Union. In June 2024, the AU adopted a landmark continental AI strategy.
Yeah. And this wasn't just a gentle suggestion.
No, it's a comprehensive multinational framework. It outlines five core focus areas: harnessing AI's benefits for development, building core AI capabilities, minimizing the risks, stimulating public and private investment, and fostering regional and international cooperation.
And the economic incentive for getting this continental strategy right is just staggering.
What are the numbers?
Well, PwC estimates that if the African continent can properly leverage and integrate this technology, AI could contribute up to $1.5 trillion to the African economy.
$1.5 trillion.
Trillion. With a T. That represents a massive 6% bump to the entire continent's gross domestic product.
That is a massive prize. But, you know, anyone can write a glossy policy paper projecting trillion-dollar futures.
Sure.
The critiques from the scholars we've been discussing, they demand a harsh reality check. They're calling for a shift away from theoretical and utopian approaches toward action-oriented, experimental, and multifaceted change processes, which, as you said, they call prefigurative politics.
Right. Let's explain what prefigurative politics actually means mechanically.
Yeah, please.
It means you don't wait for the perfect Pan-African regulatory environment to be officially legislated. You don't sit around waiting for the $1 trillion to materialize.
So what do?
You build the exact future you want in the present moment using the tools you have right now. It is all about experimental on-the-ground execution.
Okay, so how does the South African draft policy actually connect to this AU strategy and this demand for real-world execution?
Well, the South African policy explicitly recognizes that regional integration is the only viable path to global competitiveness. Because an AI model is fundamentally only as good as two things: the breadth of the data it trains on and the sheer volume of compute power that runs it.
Right.
So if every African nation hoards its own small data sets and builds tiny, isolated data centers, they will be universally crushed by the global models.
So they need what the sources call a federated data platform.
Yes.
But what does federated actually mean in this context? Because honestly, that sounds like a massive security risk if you're just dumping everyone's data into one giant continental bucket.
Right. But that's the brilliance of a federated system. Instead of putting all of Africa's sensitive healthcare data or financial data into one massive, vulnerable central server in Cape Town or Nairobi, which would be a total privacy nightmare, a federated system trains the AI locally. So the model goes to a hospital server in Nigeria, learns from the data there, adjusts its mathematical weights, and then leaves. It does the same at a hospital in South Africa and a clinic in Ghana.
Oh, wow.
It only shares the learnings, the adjusted algorithms across the network. The private, granular patient data never actually leaves its home country.
That is incredible. It allows the continent to pool its collective intelligence without compromising national sovereignty or citizen privacy.
Exactly.
But we do have to look at the massive physical barriers standing in the way of that interconnected dream. I mean, the data shows that in 2023, only 37% of Africans were actually online. You have a massive, yawning digital divide.
It's a huge hurdle. Mm-hmm. And beyond basic internet access, you have a severe lack of high-performance computers, or HPCs.
Which you need to run the AI.
Right. Training a foundational AI model requires tens of thousands of specialized microchips running simultaneously for months. The cost of that compute power is astronomical.
And it's probably exacerbated by punishing currency exchange rates against the U.S. dollar.
Absolutely. It makes it incredibly difficult.
So those are massive, heavy structural hurdles. But let's look at the flip side. Let's look at the ultimate leverage the continent holds. The demographic dividend.
Yes, the demographics are key here.
The projections show that by 2030, African youth will make up 42% of all global youth.
42%. That is a staggering statistic. Nearly half the young people on Earth.
Right. So if Africa successfully integrates its data infrastructure, if it builds these federated platforms, pooling language, agriculture, and health data, it creates an entirely unique global block.
It does.
With 42% of the global youth, they possess the future workforce, the future developers, and the future consumer base of the entire digital economy.
And if they are united digitally, they could leverage that demographic reality to dictate terms to the global tech giants.
Instead of just passively accepting the terms of service handed down from California.
Exactly. And we are already seeing this continental strategy, this prefigurative politics, manifest in the real world.
Really? Like where?
Well, think about the Windhoek statement on AI in Southern Africa, which set some early regionally specific ethical ground rules. But more importantly, look at the explosion of incredibly innovative, hyper-local startups that are building sovereign capability right now.
Oh, right. We have Lalapa AI in South Africa, and they're doing groundbreaking work focusing exclusively on African language models.
Yes.
You have Mino Health in Ghana automating complex medical diagnostics for local clinics. And you have Intron Health in Nigeria, which I think is a perfect example of what we're talking about. Intron Health is doing clinical speech recognition for heavily accented English and local dialects.
Let's drill down into why Intron Health's work is so vital.
Yeah, let's unpack that.
Because if a Nigerian doctor dictates clinical notes into a standard Western-trained medical AI, the system often fails catastrophically.
Why?
Because the acoustic models and the phoneme recognition in the Western AI were not trained on West African accents or the specific syntax of Nigerian English.
Yeah.
It misinterprets the data, which directly leads to medical errors.
Wow.
So Intron Health isn't just like fixing a glitch. They are building an acoustic AI model from the ground up that natively understands the local linguistic reality.
They are solving a hyperlocal life or death problem that global models simply ignore. Because, you know, there isn't a massive immediate profit margin in it for a venture capital firm in Silicon Valley.
Exactly. This is prefigurative politics in action.
Mm.
They are building the sovereign ecosystem brick by brick.
Okay, but I have a major challenge here regarding the South African draft policy's international alignment.
Okay, what is it?
So the document explicitly states that it aims to align with global standards, specifically mentioning frameworks from the OECD and UNESCO.
Right, that's.
But if the academic goal, as we discussed with the Audre Lorde quote and the scholars at AfroDSI, is to reject the master's tools and avoid Western epistemic bias, doesn't aligning your national AI policy with these massive Western-dominated global institutions completely dilute the push for true African AI sovereignty?
It's a very fair question.
Aren't you just voluntarily adopting the master's rulebook?
Well, this raises a vital question, and it is, honestly, the absolute crux of the tension within the draft policy.
Yeah.
Because the reality of international trade, supply chains, and digital ecosystems means you simply cannot completely isolate yourself and hope to thrive.
Okay.
If a South African AI startup wants to attract international venture capital, or if it wants to export its software solutions to markets in Europe or Asia, it has to meet global compliance and interoperability standards.
So it's basically a forced compromise.
It is a highly pragmatic compromise. The strategy seems to be learn the global language of regulation, participate in global forums, but strictly apply those frameworks to protect local sovereign interests. You use the OECD's language of safety and transparency to legally mandate the protection of local data and the funding of local research. It's playing the international game in order to change the local reality.
I see that. But to balance that global integration with actual, undeniable local sovereignty, you need one critical physical ingredient. You need a massive, unprecedented surge in homegrown talent. Right. You cannot have technological sovereignty if you don't have the engineers, the researchers, the data scientists, and the hardware technicians. Where is the physical engine coming from?
This brings us to, honestly, the most inspiring and critical part of the equation, building the engine. We have to look at the massive role of grassroots networks and South Africa's national system of innovation.
Let's talk about the deep learning in Indaba.
Yes.
In 2024, this massive gathering of the greatest technical minds on the continent was held in Dakar, Senegal. And the theme for the year was Zamzamle, which is Wolof for gather knowledge and show it.
The Indaba is the perfect, undeniable counter-narrative to the outdated idea that Africa is somehow lagging in deep technical AI expertise.
Totally.
It is a vibrant continent-wide network of cutting-edge capacity building.
The scale of what happened in Dakar is incredible. I'll ask you for the specific data because I know it highlights exactly what sovereignty looks like in practice. Was this just a small, you know, academic conference?
Not at all. We were talking about 617 elite attendees from 37 different African countries.
Wow.
They hosted intense 72-hour hacking challenges with 220 hackers building real-world AI solutions. And crucially, they highlighted major financial investments into local sovereignty.
Like what?
Like a $500,000 grant from the Lacuna Fund, specifically dedicated to supporting African language technology.
This grant money is fueling groups like Mosakane and Nijevoces. Let's explain what Mosakane is actually doing mechanically, because it proves why local research is so vital. They are working on African natural language processing, or NLP.
Right. And natural language processing is the branch of AI that gives computers the ability to understand text and spoken words.
Okay.
The problem is most AI tokenizes language based on English grammar rules.
Mm-hmm.
So if you apply English tokenization to Swahili or Zulu or Wolof,
yep.
You mathematically shatter the morphological structure of those languages.
It just breaks them.
Exactly. The AI just outputs gibberish.
It's like trying to parse a beautiful piece of poetry using the instruction manual for a microwave. It destroys the meaning.
That's exactly it. Mosakane is a decentralized research effort, fundamentally rewriting those rules.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They are building custom native tokenizers and acoustic models for low-resource African languages.
Yeah.
They're gathering the audio data, applying advanced transfer learning, and ensuring that the future of human-computer interaction isn't exclusively English.
That's so cool. And South Africa, at a national policy level, is trying to match this massive grassroots energy with specific infrastructural investments through its decadal plan.
Right.
They aren't just throwing grant money into the ether. They are building targeted, specialized AI academic hubs.
This ties back to that massive growth in academic institutes we discussed earlier. You have dedicated AI hubs established at the University of Johannesburg, the Tshwane University of Technology, the Central University of Technology,
and even a highly specialized military-focused AI hub at Stellenbosch University.
Yeah.
But I want to ask about the everyday person here. Why are these specific universities, and more importantly, the vocational schools, so critical? Because if AI is all about PhDs and elite mathematics, why does the policy focus on vocational training?
Well, what's fascinating here is the whole of society approach to innovation. The decadal plan explicitly recognizes that you cannot just fund elite, historically wealthy institutions and expect the technological benefits to magically trickle down to the rest of the country.
Trickle-down tech doesn't work.
It doesn't. A sovereign AI industry needs elite researchers, yes. But it also desperately needs thousands of technicians who can physically install server racks, cool the massive data centers, maintain the hardware,
and integrate those automated systems onto factory floors and into agricultural supply chains.
Exactly. Which is why the investment in TVET colleges, technical and vocational education and training, and historically disadvantaged institutions, or HDIs, is really the linchpin of the whole strategy.
Because if you only fund the historically wealthy universities, you are literally hard-coding the geographical and racial legacy of apartheid into the physical infrastructure of the new digital economy.
You'd just be rebuilding the past.
Exactly. You have to translate high-level policy into on-the-ground vocational reality for the majority of the population.
Furthermore, the policy heavily emphasizes science diplomacy.
What does that mean in practice?
Instead of just importing expensive foreign talent to build these data centers, they are utilizing international partnerships to mandate tech transfer, building local R&D capacity so that the next generation of infrastructure is built by locals.
I want to give a concrete, undeniable example of how powerful this local talent is when it is focused on local problems rather than Silicon Valley problems.
Sure.
At that 2024 Deep Learning in Daba in Senegal, there's a hackathon sponsored by InstaDeep. And the challenge wasn't some abstract mathematics problem. It wasn't building a chatbot to write better marketing copy.
No.
The challenge was utilizing AI for anti-venom sequencing for snake bites in Senegal.
Which is a profound life-or-death public health issue across the continent. And it receives practically zero attention or funding from Western pharmaceutical or tech companies because, you know, doesn't affect their primary consumer base.
Exactly. So let's look at the mechanics of how AI actually sequences anti-venom.
Okay.
Traditionally, identifying how a snake's venom toxins bind to human proteins requires slow, agonizing in vitro laboratory testing. It takes months or years.
It's very tedious.
But AI, specifically machine learning models designed for proteomics, can mathematically predict how those complex protein structures will fold and bind in a matter of hours.
Hours instead of years.
Yeah. The hackers at the Indaba were using advanced AI to digitally simulate the binding of venom toxins to potential antibodies, radically accelerating the discovery of life-saving treatments.
It is a perfect, shining illustration of world-class, cutting-edge artificial intelligence being deployed to address a highly specific, deadly local problem.
It really is.
It proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that the talent is there, the drive is there, and the sovereign capability is there.
And that grassroots energy from the hackers in Dakar to the researchers at the Wits Mind Institute is the lifeblood of the entire movement toward algorithmic sovereignty.
Absolutely.
Which brings me to a massive logistical question for you. Think of the South African government's draft AI policy as the steering wheel of a vehicle.
Okay, I'm with you.
It provides direction. It establishes the rules of the road. It sets up the ombudsperson and the insurance funds. But these grassroots networks, the university hubs, the students grinding in TVET colleges, they are the actual physical engine block.
Right.
Without the engine, the steering wheel is completely useless. So how does the government ensure that in its rush to regulate, to protect citizens, and align with global frameworks, it doesn't accidentally suffocate these organic grassroots movements with heavy-handed bureaucracy?
That is the ultimate regulatory balancing act. The government has to act as a gardener, not a gatekeeper.
A gardener. I like that.
The heavy regulations, the impact assessments, the explainability mandates, Those must be targeted with laser precision at high-risk massive enterprise deployments.
Like the banks and the massive corporate models.
Right. They need to target the models that affect national loan distributions, healthcare networks, and state surveillance. But simultaneously, the government must aggressively carve out regulatory sandboxes for local researchers and startups.
Meaning a safe space to fail an experiment without being sued into oblivion.
Yes. And the policy explicitly mentions targeted grants and subsidized supercomputing access for local startups, which is a very promising sign that they actually understand this dynamic.
That's encouraging.
But the actual execution will require constant, transparent, and open dialogue between the policymakers and the grassroots communities.
They need a seat at the table.
Exactly. The researchers from Afritz AI, the hackers from Masakane, the scholars like Rudkamp Bloom, they must have a permanent seat at the regulatory table, not just be consulted as an afterthought.
Okay, we have covered an immense continent-spanning amount of ground today. From the sheer terrifying velocity of the global AI race to the complex legal intricacies of South Africa's 2026 draft policy.
We've covered a lot.
We've explored the urgent fight against digital colonialism, the necessity of epistemic justice, and the vibrant grassroots engine that is actively building a sovereign future. So how do we synthesize all of this? What is the final takeaway?
Well, if we distill this entire geopolitical shift down to its essence, South Africa's 2026 draft AI policy is a necessary, highly ambitious, and globally significant step toward true algorithmic sovereignty.
Right.
The drafters have correctly identified the existential threats of algorithmic bias, unchecked data extraction, and structural inequality.
They see the threat.
They do. However, as the academic critiques rightly point out, the policy's ultimate success relies entirely on moving past theoretical bureaucratic frameworks.
Execution is everything.
It is. It must translate into fierce, action-oriented investments in local R&D capacity. It must actively work to dismantle the deep inequalities of the past through vocational training. And most importantly, it cannot succeed in isolation.
Right. It needs the rest of the continent.
It requires fostering a united, deeply integrated Pan-African technological ecosystem.
It's about taking ownership. It's about turning the raw behavioral data of the continent into refined sovereign wisdom that actually serves the people who generated it.
Beautifully said.
And that brings up a profound concept explicitly mentioned in the draft policy that I think is beautiful and entirely unique to this part of the world, the concept of Ubuntu AI.
Yes. The policy mandates the support and development of AI models that reflect African philosophy, specifically highlighting Ubuntu.
For those of you who might not be familiar with the depth of the term, Ubuntu translates roughly to "I am because we are." It is a philosophy of deep, fundamental interconnectedness.
It really prioritizes the collective community, mutual empathy, and shared humanity over sheer isolated individuality.
Exactly. And if you contrast that deeply relational, human-centric worldview with the highly individualized, fiercely competitive, and relentlessly profit-driven algorithms currently being exported out of Silicon Valley,
yeah,
it is a jarring contrast.
It's night and day. Let's look at the objective function of those global models.
Wait, you use the term objective function. What does that actually mean under the hood of the AI?
So the objective function is the core mathematical goal that the AI is programmed to optimize above all else.
Okay.
For a social media algorithm, the objective function is usually maximizing user watch time and engagement. To achieve that math, the AI learns that outrage, isolation, and conflict keep people scrolling.
So it optimizes for division.
Exactly. But Ubuntu AI fundamentally changes that underlying mathematics. What if the objective function of a resource management AI or a social network AI was mathematically designed to optimize for community cohesion?
Or cooperative resource distribution.
Right, and collective well-being.
It changes the entire architecture of the digital world. And that leaves us with a final provocative thought for you to ponder long after you finish listening to this deep dive.
Absolutely.
If artificial intelligence models are ultimately just a mirror, a digital mirror reflecting the data, the biases, the history, and the deepest values of the people who train them.
And if the African continent successfully builds a sovereign technological ecosystem rooted not in extraction, but in the philosophy of Ubuntu AI.
Could the continent that has been historically marginalized, colonized, and extracted by every previous global industrial revolution ultimately be the one to teach artificial intelligence how to be truly human?
That is the ultimate promise of algorithmic sovereignty. It is not just about building a shield to protect oneself from the future.
No.
It is about actively writing a better, more humane future for everybody.
We aren't just building extractive railroads anymore. We are building the engine for something entirely new. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep reading, keep exploring, and above all, keep questioning the algorithms that shape your world.